accession number 18258, reel 5.
It's a dance, reel 5.
At the back were two more mountings which had been welded to the body of the Jeep, and on each of those, again, was a twin Vickers machine gun, mounted higher so it could fire above the heads of the driver and his compatriot or the other guns. And these could traverse 360 degrees. So it was obvious we could cause any amount of damage with that. And we left the glider. It was all fully loaded. We went back, had a bit of a meal, and went out to the gliders and got on board. The tug aircraft was in front. His engines had started. The marshal was at the side of the runway with his flag ready to give the signals for take up slack and then take off. And suddenly a motorcyclist came riding down from the far end of the runway, riding straight towards the tug, waving one hand like that. And this was it. It was scrubbed. The troops that had got into the outskirts of Paris, we weren't needed. And I always remember it for one incident. I wanted to go on it. It seemed to me like the ultimate bit of excitement. I don't think Dickie Bird was so pleased, but he was pleased to hear it was off. But the two SAS blokes who were with me and not sitting in the Jeep, they immediately kicked at the fuselage of the glider and clicked a dirty gate hole in it and said a few words which I won't repeat. So that was off. And that's the way it went. But the troops on the ground moved forward, and of course the next one was the big one. And again, we had a special call up of all the squadron in one building with a guard all the way round. The guard used to be put outside, and then they'd all be all armed, their weapons were loaded, and they all made 20 paces out in a ring and halted. And no one was ever allowed into that ring or even coming out unless they got the instruction from inside. And we went in, and there was this big sand table, and it showed you the three main bridges that needed to be kept to captured. The one at Grave, the next one up at Nijmegen, and the next one at Arnhem. And I can hear Major Jackson saying now, well, there we are. This is the job for the 1st Airborne Division. They're all waiting to go, so this will be it, you know, because 1st Airborne hadn't been used. 6th had been used, and odds and ends in Sicily. But 1st, being called the 1st, they thought, well, why didn't we get D-Day? But in the end, of course, they got a much tougher one, as it turned out. And he said, I can hear Jackson saying now, so what's roughly going to happen is one parachute battalion and one glider-borne battalion will land at Grave, another one and one will land at Nijmegen, and another one and one at Arnhem. And that's where we've got. So I thought, well, we got the furthest one away, you know. But that was only one division doing it. But then that was cancelled. We didn't hear why, but it was cancelled. The following Sunday, it was put on again, three divisions. An American division at Grave, an American division at Nijmegen, and the 1st British Airborne Division at Arnhem. And I often think, you know, I'm no real tactician, but I could see the state of what the German army was in that week before. If we'd gone, they may have collapsed, because they were all so busy running backwards, the German army, that they wouldn't have stopped to fight and they wouldn't have organised so well. But that week gave them a chance to stop, and they really got organised. So anyway, that was our job, Arnhem. This time I had men of the Cosbys, King's Own Scottish Borderers, on board. And I saw the young officer, Lieutenant, I did have his name somewhere, but for now I don't remember. And I asked him what he felt about it, and was there any particular spot on the landing zone that he wanted to be in? He said, well, I've seen the landing zone on the map. So I said, well, we've got access to the sand table if you want to come in. So we went through the guard and into that. And the sand tables were very well done, you know, it was almost the size of this floor of this room. And you walk round it. And I said, well, look, there it is there. That's our landing zone. Right. And I said, and there's the main road that runs down to Wolfhazer and Oosterbeck and into Arnhem. Well, he said, I've got to get up on that road early. I've got a special job with the colonel. So I said, well, you pick what part of the landing zone you want. If I can get in it, I will. And he said, well, what's this up here? The sand was laid out, and we'll say it was the size of that top there, the landing zone. And just up here, the roadway was here, just up here, it looked like there was some sort of indentation in the soil. He said, what's that, a quarry? I said, I doubt if it's a quarry. May have been a bit of stone there at one time, but it's certainly a bit of a depression. He said, well, that's almost on the edge here. It wouldn't take me long to get up on the road to the colonel. So I said, fair enough, I'll aim for that. The trip over was pretty good, pretty good. And it was interesting to see, you know, the odd glider where the rope had snapped over the North Sea, going down, circling, going down slowly. And then again, these air sea rescue craft down there, rushing to pick them up. And I think they were all picked up, those who went down. Then we crossed, I think, the islands off the shore of Holland, Walcheren and these places. And most of the land was flooded. The Germans had flooded all the low-lying ground. And one or two gliders went down there. One was hit by anti-aircraft fire and had to make a landing. And I watched him going down all the time, and he splashed into the water and came to a halt, you know. So they were okay. And then we crossed the first river, the second river, and I said to Dickie Bird, the next one's ours, you know. And there was the Rhine coming up. Well, again, you've got all the massive aircraft, they're all following each other, so you couldn't really get lost. But you want to get in the right position. I cast off, turned to look at the landing zone, could see this, smacked on full flap, went down perpendicular, you know, and pulled out. And we only just made it because we got a big load on board. And went shooting across, and I kept my eye on this landing zone, and then I got the wheels down. And of course, the sand of the soil of Holland is like... almost like leaf mould or fine sand, really. It's all recovered from the sea, isn't it? So the wheels dug into that, and I thought, it's good, I'm heading right for that depression in the ground. And as we got to it, I smacked on the wheel brakes, and the front wheel of my glider went over. It was off the ground, over the gap, so the glider went down a little bit. And I always remember, because I got out, they were all glad to get out the back, and the officer said, where are we? I said, well, look at my front wheel. I said, that's the thing you said on the map. So it went great. And they went shooting off with their trucks. We helped to load their stuff for them and get them equipped, you know, to get away so they can move out. And then we stayed by the gliders to help any other crash glider or anything like that, you know. And, of course, there were some nasty crashes, some chaps couldn't get in, and they tried to land in the trees, because they smashed into the trees, and there were some horrific ones there. And of course, at that time, there weren't any parachuters coming down, you know, the parachuters came in a bit after. So we had to hold the area. Well, I could hear a bit of gunfire now and again, but nothing to speak of. So we just stayed put around the dropping zone. The landing zone, the dropping zone for the paras was the other side of the road I mentioned. And sure enough, they came in, it all came fluttering down, you know. And then there was a bit more rifle fire and that aimed by Germans at them. So we had to go out that way and see what we could do. They all moved off. And then the second lift, main lift, was coming in the next day on the Monday, you know. And we were told that it might be necessary for us to go back up and recapture the landing zone from any Germans who got there. So we moved out towards Wolfhazer, and the site down that road was a bit funny, because that's where the infamous asylum was for lunatics. And they all came running out in their nightshirts, you know, and of course they were people who were absolutely beyond the pale mentally, you know, and they were just laughing and giggling. And you had a job to get them out of the way, you know. But as far as I can recall, we went down to the Wolfhazer crossing and we dug some trenches down there and we met a few of the locals by the crossing. And I remember a woman coming out with some water to give to me, and she had a little girl in her arms of about two. And I put my big rucksack down and rummaged around it because I knew I'd got some sandwiches in there, but I'd got an orange, which you didn't see very often, you know. And I knew what the Dutch emblem was, the colour is orange. And I gave this to the little girl, and of course the woman cried. The kid had never seen an orange in her life, naturally. But then I told her she ought to go in and get away from it all. And soon enough we were called back to go up to the landing zone and help clear some Germans away from there, which we did as best we could. But it was starting to get a little bit chaotic, but then of course the next day arrived and the second load of gliders came in and they met a bit of resistance, and some of them were shot up as they came in. And one poor devil, he'd landed and his run, if you can imagine it, in a straight line, you always tried to keep it straight so everyone else knew you would stay straight. And he was running straight into a heavy machine gun, which simply opened up on him and killed the lot. And when we'd cleared the ground a few hours later, we got to the glider and they were all dead. And of course, by then, the machine gun crew were dead as well, but that was a nasty sight there. Because we knew the glider pilots, of course. And then it was everyone down to Wolfhazer, where we really dug in the lovely gardens of these beautiful little houses down there, because it was a very top-class residential area between Wolfhazer and Oosterbeek. But we dug in there, and it wasn't long before German troops came into sight, you know. And there was a good bit of fighting went on. Some German prisoners were taken and they were put in a couple of tennis courts which were down near the Hartenstein Hotel. That was the only place they could put them. And if we caught any, we had to take them down there. And myself and Dickie Bird and another chap, Bill Taylor, we occupied a slit trench in one garden, and then there was a lot of firing coming from the back of us. And we went round to find what it was, and by creeping around various things, that we saw these Germans with a machine gun, and there were only two of them, and they were firing straight into these buildings, and we let fly at them and threw a few grenades, and they surrendered, and they were SS. They got the old SS on their dog collars. Rough-looking couple. And we took them back, but by the time we got down to where we dug our trench and that, heavy shell fire was coming in and mortar fire, and it was plastering all over that area. And we dived into the trench. I told the Germans to lay flat, and they tried to be arrogant, you know, you don't lie flat. And they were, you know, standing up. It was like it was their own shells. So I said, right, well, cross-legged on the ground in the middle of the road, put your hand on your head like that. They got them down. Went back to my trench and kept my Thompson submachine gun on them. And old Bill Taylor said to me, I don't think they're going to stay there much longer. I said, if they get up and run, I'm going to kill them. And, you know, they started to move. I fired one shot. And by the time the shelling had finished, and they'd been sitting like that, totally exposed, they were really gibberish. So we put them in the tennis courts with the others, and that was that. But I've no idea of time now. We must now be running about the Tuesday, I would think, following the Monday, in other words, the third day of the battle. And it was getting more and more intense, this shelling. And most of it was out beyond the perimeter around the Hartenstein Hotel. And that must have been out where the airborne troops had gone and the paratroops. A lot had gone down the main road to try and get into Arnhem, of course, which was the objective, but gradually they were being driven back. So it was all defensive positions around the Hartenstein. And we were still grouped around the Hartenstein as reserve. And then suddenly this brigadier came out of the Hartenstein and approached my section commander, Lieutenant Thompson, who was younger than me, T-O-M-S-O-N, unusual spelling of that name. And he shouted out, "Lieutenant, I want 10 glider pilots down this road until you come to a large, very large building called De Hemmersberg. And I want you to fan out round there, and you've got to hold that ground." So I was 2IC of the section, so he said to me, "You pick them." So I had my second pilot with me and 8 others, and off we went. And of course, going down there, we were going into the shell fire where it was dropping. It was really naughty. A jeep passed us, and he'd gone about 100 yards, and a shell hit him direct. And he just, everything went, you know, they were all killed. There were about 8 on it too, I think. And then the petrol tank blew up, and it was like a torch signalling the way down there, you know. We went down and found this big house, which had been badly damaged by shell fire. And obviously it was a wealthy person's home because it was all like parkland round it, you know. And a big outbuilding, which once we got down there, we could hear voices, and it was full of Dutch people, especially women with children. And Thompson said, "We'll leave them there for now. Let's get ourselves in good defensive positions." And he left it to me because I was ex-infantry, you know, and I'd had a bit of experience. And I put them out in pairs so that they weren't on their own, and told them to dig a slit trench. And we did a semicircle right the way round facing the enemy. And I'd already noticed that there were two pathways or tracks coming up towards us from right and left, which met together about 100 yards from the building. So I made sure I had a good pair under a big rhododendron bush. They found it very difficult to dig a slit trench because of the roots, but they were hidden under there, and they had a Bren gun. And I found one for myself and Dickie Bird and Bill Taylor. And then I went back to Thompson. I said, "I don't know what you're going to do about those civvies, because, you know, they're going to die in there. You know, they're not below ground as we're getting." So we both went along and told them they ought to go, but they didn't want to go. They thought they were safe. But it was only a brick building with a thatched wooden roof on it, you know, and the first shell would have set it on fire. And they were crammed in there, and there were so many kiddies, you know, in wheelchairs too. Anyway, eventually we got them out, and we said, "Well, look, we know that the Germans are down there. Go down this track and take that one on the left, and before you go, get a white sheet or something," and they had plenty of those with them, "and make sure you've got it held up." And we watched them go right the way down to near the end, and then they stopped. And we saw these Germans come out and grab them and move away, and we said, "Well, at least we've got them out of it, you know." So, and it gave us a rough idea where the Germans were too. But they were far enough away not to be hit by their own shells. And I said to Thompson at the time, you know, "When it's dark, we'd do better if we moved out more nearer to them, because they're going to start shelling this place like mad," which they did. Because by then it was too late to get out. And we stuck that shelling all that day and night. I think that must have been about the fourth day by then. And the next day dawned. And the shelling eased for a while during daylight. And I thought, there's something on here. They're moving up. They must be. They're not. They can shell us night and day. They won't lose anyone. But if they want to put up some patrols to have a look, see where we are, they've got to stop the shelling. And I told Thompson this, but about an hour went by. And I said, "Well, I still don't like it. I'm sure they're going to come in. I'm going to go round the lads and tell them what I think." So I went to each of the spots where they were, because I knew exactly. And this one under the bush, the only chap I remember the name of was a chap named Ranger, Sergeant Ranger, who was a second pilot, very tall chap. And of course, he was always called Tex by everyone, Tex, Texas Ranger. And he had this Bren gun, and I made sure he had some more ammo. And I said, I've got a feeling you're going to be busy with those tracks down there. So he said, OK, we'll keep ready. But of course, we weren't getting any real sleep. But I went round the rest, came back, and I was coming back nearer to the house, midway between the house and the rhododendron bush and the tracks. And I looked down the tracks, and coming up the left-hand track was a section of Germans with two heavy machine guns in single file, using the track and coming straight up. And obviously Tex, you know, probably dozed off or so, wasn't ready. And I screamed out, Tex, left track. And I had this Thompson submachine gun, and I took deliberate aim and fired and loaded up and kept firing, because they all disappeared. And Tex had opened up, meanwhile, with the Bren gun, because the rest of them wondered what the hell was going on. And I told them, and I think some of them didn't believe it. But that night, all we could hear was a weak voice saying, Tommy, Tommy, camarade, camarade. And I said, well, there's one alive out there, you know. And he kept on. It was getting weaker. And Thompson said to me, how do you feel about it? I said, well, I think we ought to try and do something. When the shelling eases a bit, we'll go down and see if we can get him in. And we went down the track, and because they were all to the side in the undergrowth, and they were all dead except this one. And he'd obviously been hit by my Thompson submachine gun, because a bullet had gone through his hand here, and all the tendons and bone was spread out. Now, that had to be a heavy caliber bullet to do that. And he'd had one through the groin, out through the back, and another one up here. And
on
one,
his shot, on his clavicle.
Yeah, and one had clipped his jaw, you know, typical of the fire from a Thompson gun. Anyway, we went to carry him because he screamed as we tried to pick him up. We went back, and I said, well, in that outhouse was an old wickerwork chair, you know. See if we can get him on that. So we had to run back and get that, and go back down again and get him into this chair. We carried that between us till we got back to the house. Now, the day before, the house had been hit several times and had burned and been gutted right the way down. And the family, a family named Bielouts van Blokland, were in the cellar. And every now and again they came up to see us, but they stayed in the cellar. They were relatively safe down there, you know. That was a father and mother and two daughters. They were both teenagers. And when they asked for food, if we had any, we gave them what we could, but we had nothing ourselves, really. So we brought the German up against the wall of the building because the brickwork was still hot. You know how bricks hold the heat. Well, he was shivering, and he hadn't got long, obviously. And we laid him right against that, and he sort of rested a bit. And then one of the other lads said, we've made the last drop of tea, Reg. Have you had any? I said, no, I haven't had any at all. He said, well, here it is, and it must have been a little bit more than that, you know, in a mess tin. And I watched this German look at me, and he said, drink, drink, you know. And I said, tea. He said, oh, yeah. And I held it to him, and he got his other hand up and tipped it and drank a lot. So I thought, well, that's the end of my tea. And about 4 minutes later, he died. So I wasn't sorry, you know, but he was going to die anyway. So he was left there. I'm sure we'd got into the sixth day, and Tex kept seeing movement down here and opening up with the Bren gun, and I went down and we had a look and all the rest of it. And the Jerry were closing in tighter all the time. And so it was really nail-biting. And then there was a bit of a lull, and I dropped down into my trench with Bill Taylor and Lieutenant Thompson. And then suddenly I could hear someone running. I could hear it on the ground. And I looked up, because it was Tex Ranger running from his bush up to me. And he jumped in. And he said, we're getting short of ammo. I said, well, we're all short of ammo, but We'll let you have a few more rounds, but you'll have to make sure and only fire single shots, you know. And he stayed, and then he said, I better get back now. I said, no, hang on a bit, it started up again. I said, it'll probably last about another quarter of an hour, so you're safer in and out there. Well, he stayed, and it started to ease up, and he said, I'm going now. He said, old Charlie, we'll be getting worried, think I've left him. I said, well, that's why I said, I would always come round and speak to you. He said, I'm going now, and he leapt up and ran, and there was this great orange burst and thump and heat. We were all right. I looked up, and his head had been blown off from his jaw upwards, and it was just the body quivering until it stopped, you know. So he never knew what had him, poor devil, but he was lying there. So the next time we got an opportunity, we laid him alongside the dead German, you know, and we told the Dutch family, and they didn't like the look of it at all, but I said, it could help you if anything goes wrong. You could say you've looked after British and Germans, you know, because it was very prophetic when I said that, because we got round to day number 8, which was what, the Monday, that's Monday week after the landing, and during a bout of tremendous shell fire and mortar fire, I was in the same slit trench, and a shell must have hit one of the trees or what was left of a tree above us, but it burst over our head and something hit me in the back like an express train and threw me straight at Thompson, who's, you know, at the first time you said, for God's sake, get up, Red, you're choking me. I said, I can't, I've been hit. What do you mean you've been hit? I said, I'm bleeding badly from the back. The moment I was hit, I felt all this like hot water running down my back, down my backside and down both legs. And it was the wound bleeding badly, you know. And of course they saw it all on my dirty uniform, so they realised that was right. So we stayed put. Then they laid me up by the two dead ones, because it was a bit warmer there. And I think they thought there was a bit of shelter from what was left of the walls. But of course, at the same time, the order came down that we were pulling out that night. And I thought, oh God, I would have to get it now, you know. So I said to them, look, if you can get a plank or something, get me on, you might be able to pull me along. Or if I can get up, you know, I'll go with you. But when I got up, I was paralysed down the right side and I couldn't do anything. The leg, the arm had packed up, the fragment had entered me just at the spine and come out down here. There's a big long trough in my bone up here. See it all
in
missing.
Your shoulder?
Yeah. And it was the nerves that had been hit badly, you know. If it didn't spin that, I might have been able to make it. So they said, oh, they would carry me. But I said, you'll be lucky to get alive. Be sensible, leave me here. I just hope I get picked up, you know. So they left me there and went off. We shook hands with left hand. I wished them luck. And I asked Bill Taylor and Thompson if they got back to write to my mother. Well, they both got back, so they both wrote. And I have the letters upstairs in my stuff. And off they went. Well, the hours went by. And the Dutch people came out to see me now and again, but they kept saying to me, you've been asleep. But I wasn't asleep, I was passing out, you know. And I don't know how much more time went on, but the shelling was still going on. And then it got to about midday, I think, and the shelling started to ease, and then I heard German voices. And then one of the girls was with these three Germans.